Hello and welcome to another special bonus episode of Damn Interesting Week. Regular visitors to the site will have noticed that the curated link section as a whole has been taking a well-deserved break this week, and it's real hard for us to talk about articles that don't exist. So instead, we've dug into the archives to bring you some of our favorite articles about legal situations you will probably, hopefully, never find yourself in. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
And these were some damn interesting weeks. First Link. All right, well, I love a good underdog story, and this one is amazing. It comes from the CBC. It's fundamentally about a Canadian court case in 1980. But to understand what happened, we have to go back to 1967, when a World's Fair was hosted in Montreal called Expo 67. And as you would expect with a World's Fair, many different countries had exhibitions at this fair, including the former Soviet Union. And as is the case with any major international conference, local vendors provided a lot of services to the various exhibitions because, you know, why ship everything across the ocean when you can just buy it when you get there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of these vendors was a man named Wally Edwards, who ran a small printing business. And he was hired by the Soviet Union to print, you know, a bunch of banners or flyers or who knows what. But after the conference was over, they never paid him. And the amount of money they owed him was both small and big at the same time. It was $36,000, which to Wally was, of course, very significant. But from the perspective of a national government, it's nothing. And it's kind of unclear why they wouldn't pay up, other than maybe they just decided they could get away with it. But
rude.
Wally was a determined man. And he spent the next 13 years fighting to get his money from the government of the Soviet Union.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he was not going to take it lying down. First, he exhausted every available avenue from the Soviet side of things. You know, he's like trying to get in touch with ambassadors and whoever he can, but he just couldn't get anybody on their side to talk to him or even acknowledge the debt in any way. But he documented everything he did, and ultimately he made it to a Canadian court and got a ruling in absentia that, yes, the Soviet Union owed him this money. And in the process of doing this, he racked up $30,000 in legal fees. So,
well, of course,
you know, everybody thought he was crazy, especially because the Canadian courts had no ability to actually enforce this payment, right? They were just like, yeah, okay, we officially tell you you're right, but that doesn't mean anything. And in the meantime, the printing business itself had gone bankrupt in 1973. But Wally was just on a mission. He was not going to let this go. So this is where it gets kind of insane. With his court ruling in hand, he went to the Toronto Sheriff's Office and he said, listen, Soviet cargo ships dock every day in the Toronto Harbor. So the next time one comes into port, you're going to seize the ship as collateral on my debt.
Ooh,
and
wow.
The Toronto sheriff was like, yeah, that's nice, buddy. I'm not going to do that. So Wally sued the sheriff for dereliction of duty.
Oh.
And again, miraculously, the court ruled in his favor. The sheriff had to do it. And so the sheriff was like, fine, I guess. And so on October 3rd, 1980, the MV Stanislavski pulled into port and the local sheriff came aboard. He removed the crew and he took control of this multi-million dollar Soviet ship as collateral for a random debt for a printing business 13 years earlier.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you
What were the goods on the ship? I mean, did it not matter because the ship itself had been basically taken?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what they were looking at. I imagine it probably came off the ship because it was bound for other places. But the ship itself was Soviet government property.
Right.
Therefore,
oh my God.
Yeah. And it did get the Soviet government's attention. But for about 2 weeks, they stonewalled him and kind of just tried to turn the whole thing into an international incident. They're basically like, Canada has seized one of our ships. And the Canadian government's like, no. A private local government has seized your ship, as, you know, as you do, I guess. But somehow, and I at this point, I got to think, like, Wally is a very persuasive, charismatic guy because he got the courts to freeze the Soviet Union's bank accounts in Ottawa. Like, froze the bank accounts of an entire country. And all of a sudden, they started negotiating with him. So by now, Wally had a few demands beyond the original bill. First off, he wanted the $36,000 he was owed, but he wanted it in $1 bills so that the delivery of the money would be more dramatic for the press photos. He also wanted $30,000 to cover his legal fees. And to top it off, he demanded a case of caviar and a bottle of vodka.
Wow.
That's so gutsy.
Yeah. It's just basically like a little, you know, thumb your nose at these guys at this point.
Or, you know, 13 years worth of interest. And I think they were getting off pretty light considering there wasn't like a traditional interest rate applied to this loan.
Yeah, absolutely. And he got it.
Wow.
When the package was delivered, Wally held a big party slash press conference in a big fancy hotel. There were Canadian flags everywhere and they had O Canada playing in the background. And he basically dumped out this giant burlap sack of small bills while feasting on caviar. He presented his lawyers with a special commemorative beer tankard that he had made for the occasion. Like, he was absolutely soaking in it at this point. He was so happy to have won. And, you know, good for him, I think. They owed him the money for sure.
Oh, yeah. That was like a life's work that took place in 13 years, basically.
Yeah. They don't say whether, like, typically when you become obsessed with something like this, like along the way, you lose your family, you lose all your friends.
Right.
And they don't mention any of that. So maybe that happened and he just didn't care because he's like, I've got my caviar. That's what I wanted.
But I mean, he was in the right.
Yeah,
it sounds like based on all the facts here, good for Wally sticking to his guns.
Yeah.
And I mean, honestly, he sounds like a very competent person.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he was just very wisely, tactfully juggling all this, but as a showman the entire time.
Right. And, you know, you got to figure maybe it's free publicity for whatever business he was running at that point. Because, like I said, the printing business had gone bankrupt. And actually, there is a little twist at the end. In the middle of this big press release and party, of course, everybody had heard about this incident by then at the time. A woman showed up who said she used to work for Wally at the printing business, and she reminded him that she had never gotten her final paycheck when the company went bankrupt.
Wally.
And they don't say what happened to her. I imagine he probably just gave her some money and was like, cool, whatever, I'm rich now. I mean, he's not rich. He's barely gotten back what he was owed.
Yeah, I mean, if you divide $36,000 over 13 or so years, it's not a ton of money to invest in. But, you know, somebody's pride is occasionally worth it, I guess.
Yeah. Hey,
and they got the international incident that they were warned they were getting into and apparently had.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the Soviet Union learned their lesson and paid their contractors from then on out. Or maybe they didn't because they went bankrupt pretty shortly after that.
That's a good point, yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
Well, speaking of unnatural fabricated substances, this article comes to us from foodandwine.com and it's titled, Irish Court Says Subway Bread is Too Sugary to Be Called Bread.
Oh, snap.
Yeah.
I gotta say, it doesn't surprise me. That stuff, it's weird. Like, Subway bread smells different than other bread. Do you guys, am I the only one who knows, like, has experienced that?
Wasn't there some kind of compound used in the bread that is also found in yoga mats?
Would not
surprise. Do you guys remember hearing about
this? I think I do, and that it's just, there comes a point where you're just like, sure, might as well. Like, you know?
Yeah. Well, actually, you're spoiling my article,
Andy,
so let's get into it.
Oh, no. Forgive me.
No worries. It's still very entertaining. The court case itself is a slightly confusing one, unless you're well-versed in Irish tax policies. But it started when a Subway franchise owner challenged the tax authority's decision not to issue a refund for value-added tax, or VAT, which is a tax system in Europe, on some takeout foods. Galway-based Bookfinders LTD said that it shouldn't have to pay VAT on hot coffee and tea, or on the hot sandwiches that weren't eaten inside the restaurant.
Okay.
So, its argument was that since the sandwiches contain bread, they should be considered a staple food and shouldn't be taxed. But the five Supreme Court judges countered by suggesting that those sandwiches aren't served on bread at all, at least not under the statutory definition of bread.
I mean, so all of this was a tax avoidance strategy that uncovered all this garbage?
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
And can you imagine, I mean, the bad press that Subway's gotten out of this now. I mean, if they had just kept their mouth shut, but instead they had to go and say, we want to save a little money, and now they've had the world announce that their bread isn't bread.
Yeah.
Well, it was only one franchisor, right? Or was it like a full...
Exactly. It was one franchisor who caused this whole thing to happen in Ireland. So I'm sure Subway is not happy about that.
I can imagine.
So according to the Irish Independent, the judges ruled that Subway's bread is not a staple food because its sugar content is 10% of the weight of the flour in the dough.
That's
which is
enormous.
Wild. Yeah, that's a lot. Like, think of
that's
how big,
like,
yeah, a 1 foot Subway sub is 10% sugar of the bread. Like, that's so much.
Yeah, that's like a couple inches. Like, that's,
yeah. So the Value Added Tax Act 1972 stipulates that sugar, fat, and bread improver cannot add up to more than 2% of the weight of the flour. And those limits are in place to prevent things like pastries and other sweet baked goods from being labeled as staple foods and exempt from being taxed.
Mm-hmm.
So Justice O'Donnell dismissed Bookfinder's appeal on Tuesday, although he did acknowledge that some of the arguments presented were ingenious. An appeal commissioner also said that Subway's hot sandwiches were not eligible for a 0% tax rate, so Bookfinder's was doubly denied.
Oh, so now he like owes them a lot of money.
Yeah, wow. I think so. So this isn't the first minor controversy about the content of Subway's baked goods either. In 2014, a petition circulated asking its U.S.-based restaurants to remove an ingredient called azodicarbonamide from its breads. Let me try and get that, just in case you want to use the real word. To remove an ingredient called azodicarbonamide. Sorry, y'all. This is a really... Something is f***ing me up here with this word. All right.
Please keep this.
To remove an ingredient called azodicarbonamide from its breads. Got it.
Yay! All right.
Although the FDA has approved the use of Azzy as a whitening agent for cereal flour and as a dough conditioner, it is also found in yoga mats, shoe soles, and synthetic leather.
There it is.
Yeah.
It's a dough conditioner, so it makes it silky soft to the touch.
Yeah, kind of stretchy. And...
yeah, and a whitener too, which is like too close to bleach in some ways. Yeah.
Ooh.
So it is worth noting that Australia and the European Union have both discontinued its use in food products. And Subway, after a petition started making its way around the internet, said, even though this ingredient is safe, we are removing it from Subway bread.
Mm.
This process began last year and is nearly completed. We have already developed an improved bread formula, conducted extensive performance and consumer testing on it, and pending final government approvals, we should complete the entire conversion process within the coming weeks.
Yeah, yoga mats are performance tested too. Like, performance testing doesn't make it sound any better.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I think this article pulled a little bit of a fast one on us, presenting old news as current news, because now the article ends saying, 6 years later, the bread is ostensibly better. And for now, we can still call it bread in this country.
Can't do it in Ireland.
Country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very true.
That's definitely something I've seen a lot of, is like fast food companies here put in a bunch of junk that overseas they are not allowed to put in legally. So like if you go to a McDonald's overseas, it will be a objectively better food product than it is here.
Yeah.
But who wants that kind of nanny state telling you what to eat? Come on.
If I want to eat a yoga mat, the government can't tell me not to.
I want my bread with Azzy in it, dang it.
I like that you guys are on nickname basis. I mean, you did spend a lot of time putting in the work.
Right, right.
But Azzy just is way catchier.
You've gotten to know each other.
Yeah, even said it right once or twice. Like, yeah. Next link.
Next link.
I got a quickie here from BBC News. I almost want to read it out loud just as it is because it's so short. But the headline is Vienna police fine man €500 for, quote, massive intestinal wind.
Oh, wow.
That's illegal now? Like, I...
Well, yeah, it's not often that people face financial consequences for breaking wind in public, but one man in Vienna was fined €500 because he did so at police.
So it was like, it was a directed aggressive thing.
Yeah, in the words of Monty Python, he farted in their general direction and paid the price. The city's police have defended the fine, saying it was really for more than that. Quote, of course, no one will be reported for accidentally letting one go once, but basically the charge sheet indeed showed that he was issued for violating public decency. It was shared on social media because, of course, the police department said the suspect, quote, had already behaved in a provocative manner when he was approached by police in the early hours of June 5th. He then rose from a park bench, looked at the officers, and apparently intentionally released a massive intestinal wind in the immediate vicinity of the officers.
So, I mean, basically, they got him under, like, biohazard laws. Like, I can't imagine there's a law on the books that says you can't fart at an officer. But if they say, oh, it's like spitting on somebody, like, it's a biohazard kind of threat.
I mean, they've got the perfect legal doctrine of whoever smelt it, felt it, so.
That's held up in court, I think.
We may find out. There's no word on this article whether he is going to contest the charges, whether he has already paid the fine. I'm guessing this just sort of serves as a general warning in the current environment that we're in. Some of us may take heed, others may take Beano. Who knows? Next link.
Next link.
So we got another one from Canada, another CBC article. This one is called $500,000 bet on rock, paper, scissors ruled invalid by Quebec court.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So
that's a lot of money on a rock, scissors, paper bet.
And they really don't explain how the bet came to be. They just say that in 2011, Edmund Mark Hooper and his friend Michelle Primo bet the American equivalent of $517,000 on a best 2 out of 3 game of rock, paper, scissors. And that was it. Like, who?
Oh, how stressful.
Yeah. I really want more backstory on these guys. Like, what were they thinking that this was a good idea? And then who actually holds their friend to that bet? Because he did. Hooper lost and he had to take out a mortgage on his home to pay off the debt. So it's not like these are just, you know, billionaires playing with money that meant nothing to them. This was a crazy set of circumstances. But because he took out a mortgage on his home, the bank got involved. And when the bank found out, hang on a second, you're using this to pay off a debt. That's ridiculous. We're not okay with this. We want to take our mortgage loan back. So because, of course, Hooper was like, well, you can't. I already gave it to my friend. They went to court and the bank said, we want our money back. This whole thing was invalid. Make Primo give it back to us. And the judges ruled the contract invalid for 2 reasons. Number one, Canadian law says that wager amounts can't be excessive. And that's one of those, you know, what a reasonable person says. There is no actual definition of what's excessive. It's left up to the judges. But all of the judges in this case said, yeah, that's not a reasonable amount of money to bet on a rock, paper, scissors game of all things.
Right.
The second reason, which is kind of more interesting, Canadian law says that any wager must be related to activities, quote, requiring only skill or bodily exertion on the part of the parties. Basically, it can't be a game of chance. And it's sort of their way of outlawing some gambling, but not all gambling. And the judges, a lot of them disagreed on this. The first judge said, oh, no, this is not a game of chance. In certain precise circumstances, the game can call upon the skill of the parties, particularly in the speed of execution, the sense of observation, or the putting in place of a strategic sequence. But she ruled that nonetheless, it's invalid because of the money. And they appealed it and they kind of went up the court. And the final court, which still said, no, it's invalid because of the money. They were careful to note, no, it's a game of chance. And that part is also a reason this should be thrown out. But I think that by the time you're getting judges debating on the chance or planned nature of a game of rock, paper, scissors, you've kind of lost the point.
So in given those parameters, would something like arm wrestling for $20 be acceptable?
Right, because then it's your actual strength. You're actually doing something in order to win the bet. And of course, this means that betting on sporting events is apparently allowed in Canada. The only thing you can't bet on is like in casinos or things where it's a random chance, which, you know, if you're trying to tamp down on the more insidious social effects of gambling, but not take people out of the standard March Madness pool or whatever, it seems like a nice little dividing line to say, no, there has to be some skill involved.
But rock, paper, scissors, I mean, there are some quote-unquote strategies, right?
Right.
Like, I feel like there are some studies that have been done that if you do 2 scissors in a row, then the next one's probably going to be a rock or something like that. There's some kind of psychology just because it's a limited data set of what your options are. I know that there are rock, paper, scissors tournaments out there as well. And so there have got to be some developed strategies. I wonder if they would take that up to the Supreme Court in Canada.
That's right. Well, and I've seen as well an AI that can beat you at rock, paper, scissors every time. And what it's really doing is using high-speed cameras that are trained on your hand, and it starts to anticipate as you're forming the shape. It sees what you're about to form and quickly does its hand shape. But it's cheating.
But that is a type of skill then, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like if you have somebody who's like a super sensor, they can process things visually a little bit quicker. Why not?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that we have definitely been cheated in not being provided the circumstances that led to such an outrageous bet over those means.
Yeah, no, I feel like there has to be more in the depositions or something that we can dig up that's public record, because it's just not enough information. You can't say, oh, yeah, we had a bet for $500,000 over rock, paper, scissors. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, next link?
Next link!
So this article comes from the Detroit News, and it is titled, In North Michigan Woods, Feds Raid an Alleged Upscale Art Forgery Factory.
Ooh. Huh.
Yeah. So FBI agents raided a home in northern Michigan this week while investigating a sophisticated art forgery ring that allegedly tricked connoisseurs into buying phony paintings purported to be from top American artists.
Mm.
The raid targeted Traverse City resident Donald Henkel, a 60-year-old self-described artist who's accused in a sealed FBI search warrant of orchestrating a years-long conspiracy involving previously unknown paintings by well-known artists and counterfeit sports memorabilia claimed to have belonged to Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and other legends.
Huh.
So he wasn't making replicas of known works. He was making new works and saying, this is by this famous person you've heard of.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh. He was replicating the styles and saying that they were new pieces that were heretofore undiscovered.
Mm-hmm.
So Elizabeth Feld is managing director of Herschel and Adler in New York City, which is one of the country's top American art galleries. And she describes it as every dealer's nightmare. The gallery spent about $500,000 on paintings linked to the forgery scheme.
Wow.
Yeah. She said these were very beautiful, fake or not. And whoever did this is an accomplished artist, just not the artist he or she purported to. So the search warrant records also reveal how FBI agents discovered the forgeries after learning the type of paint used in one composition did not exist at the time of the artwork's supposed creation almost 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. You gotta watch out for that one, art forgists. They also were hoping to find supplies that would help produce the forged artworks and sports memorabilia, which was anything from bats to baseballs to lathing tools, grease pencils, and shellac. But they did not actually say what items were seized, just because the FBI has everything under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
And there haven't been any explicit arrests yet, but they're definitely searching the property. Investigators believed Henkel worked with co-conspirators in California, Florida, and Virginia to sell the phony artwork. So in May 2016, Henkel sold one painting purportedly created by Crawford. The buyer, who was only identified as victim 3, actually purchased the painting at auction, and bank records show that $299,000 were transferred to Henkel's account.
Wow. I mean, it made it all the way to the auctions. I mean, obviously they were going through proper channels to actually offload these forgeries.
Yeah.
Well, and you got to think how many different people looked at it and said, yeah, this is legit. Because certainly people have tried forgeries in the past.
Yeah.
So you have to, like, it makes sense to me that he had conspirators in multiple states, because somebody's got to be passing this off down a chain before it ever gets to a place where enough people have said, yeah, this is real. Let's auction it off.
You know, the irony here, too, is that for people who have advanced art degrees or whatever, and probably are never going to recoup whatever it costs to actually get those degrees, but they have a lot of skill in this. This is probably the only, like, profitable avenue for them, just because the art market is such a racket. It's highly subjective. There are huge sums of money. I've always been really suspect of the high fine art market anyway, and always get a little bit of a tickle thrill whenever something like this happens.
You're like, the auction house can stand to be out $500,000.
You're fine. You know, victim number 3, my heart goes out to you, but I'm sure you're going to be fine.
Right?
Yeah.
If you can drop $300K on a painting, you're probably able to take the hit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, at least one of these pieces might be able to pay for my abandoned art school degree.
Right.
So. Shani Brook, who's the owner of Higher Art Gallery in downtown Traverse City, actually describes Henkel as an unwelcome fringe figure on the area art scene. He gained some attention for creating a 6-foot-tall bronze sculpture called Rain Man, placed outside the village at Grand Traverse Commons, which is a local shopping development. And she says, I don't want to know him. He used to come into the gallery a lot, but we've never shown his work or represented or worked with him. He is one of those people that likes to get a thrill out of making you feel uncomfortable.
Okay, so he's
really
a jerk.
Just like, yeah. But I mean, you know, the art gallery owner not taking an artist's work. I mean, how uncomfortable is that for any kind of burgeoning artist who clearly has enough skill to pull the wool over the eyes of conservators, rich victims of auction houses? I know I'm getting a little defensive about this guy because artists get a really bad shake, especially in America, but dang.
Well, it also maybe goes to show, though, like, no matter how talented you are, if you're a jerk, you're not going to be successful. Like, maybe he truly is that talented, but also he's walking around being this arrogant, horrible human being. And so everyone's like, we don't really care how good you are.
That's fair. It's hard to say because it's also he's got these three co-conspirators. So who knows if he's even doing the paintings? Maybe he's the sculpture guy and he just never succeeded. So he's using somebody else's work to make money and then splitting it three ways.
Well,
in which case,
he can pivot this into some good project management skills because
exactly.
You know, herding cats is a thing and herding artist cats, a whole other level.
Yeah, well, so now he's going to be able to do that from prison. He'll be able to, like, start a really impressive cigarette forgery ring. And
next link?
Next link.
All right, well, I have one quick little one here at the end. This comes from the Brussels Times. A Belgian man named Jean Van Landingham. He lives in Flanders, Belgium. He's 65 years old. He lives a pretty, you know, rural, normal life, except he has been receiving large food delivery orders that he did not order for 9 years. What? Yes. What? So these orders come on a weekly, sometimes daily basis. It's mostly pizzas, but also kebabs, pitas, pretty much any local food place that delivers has been out to his house at some point. He says it can
be... Wait, is he expected to pay for them or are they prepaid?
No, he is refusing them every time they come out, so he doesn't have to pay, which means the restaurant eats the cost. Basically, the restaurants are out. And you got to think, like, at some point, they would put this guy's address on a do not go list. Like, at some point, they got to run out of restaurants. But he said, actually, some of them have been coming from outside the surrounding town, so whoever is sending these is sort of branching out because they've figured out that they're not coming anymore.
What did this guy do to get all these prank pizzas delivered to him, though?
I don't know. He says it's weekdays or weekends, any time of day. He said he had orders delivered to him at 2 a.m. He said, quote, I cannot sleep anymore. I start shaking every time I hear a scooter on the street. I dread that someone will come by to drop off hot pizzas yet another time. And it doesn't seem to be slowing down either. In just January of 2019, 10 different delivery men showed up on the same day, all of them having just massive orders. One had 14 pizzas. I mean, these are just giant, giant orders of food. And he says he has no idea where they come from, but there is a clue, which actually probably makes things more confusing than less. He said a friend of his who lives in a nearby town is going through exactly the same thing. She has been receiving pizza that she has not ordered for 9 years as well.
Okay, when he says friend, is this like an ex-lover? Because I'm starting to feel like this is a very determined, spurned someone who is just like getting a kick out of torturing this guy with delicious food.
I don't know. I mean, he says, he says it's likely that it's someone they both know, which seems reasonable.
Yeah.
And he says he's reported the deliveries to the police several times, but they're not going to trace it out because they would have to trace a phone call as it's coming in, and instead it's just not worth it. Just keep refusing the orders. So, you know,
police.
I'm very cynical. My first thought was like, no. This guy's doing it to himself. Like he's weird, and he's just sort of got this obsessive, likes to torture delivery drivers. He likes to go through this thing. It's his fetish. I don't know. And also, he's suckered in this woman. Or maybe it hasn't been happening to him. It's only been happening to this woman, and he's like trying to connect with her. I don't know. It's pure conjecture. But I feel like there clearly has to be something. This isn't random. Somebody, like you said, they're mad at him and the woman or...
And it's been going on long enough to possibly explain away something like maybe like a default address in some kind of online ordering system, like a bug that's defaulting to him and his lady friend. But this is very suspicious.
Yeah. So I don't know what this guy's deal is, but certainly I have to say putting it out on a national news organization like the Brussels Times, probably not the best way to make it stop. Like, I feel like he's going to get a lot of trolls sending more now. But they didn't put his address in, so you'd have to find his name and his little town in Belgium. But how many Jean Van Landinghams can there be in his town? I feel like he's just made his problem worse. So I don't know.
Yeah,
Will.
Or he could potentially pivot it into a social service if he were able to like work with, you know, food banks or something like that. I mean, he may have to move, you know, if that's
right.
the case.
Right.
He can just like turn his house into sort of like a hot takeout soup kitchen kind of situation if he could secure some kind of nonprofit funding. But...
Yeah, if he could get people to actually pay for it. Because that was one of the things he said. He does the math occasionally when a really big order comes in. He said some of them are upwards of 400 euros. So, of course,
Good Lord.
He's like, I'm not going to pay for that. But yeah, if someone wanted to, I suppose they could set up a food bank there.
This feels like there should be an easy fix, but good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. We got to keep an eye on this guy as well. See what's up with him. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this bonus episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. As always, if you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteristingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.